that. We find Joseph now in the second in command of all of Egypt. And Egypt at this particular time basically is in charge of all the ancient world. They're the leading nation. Pharaoh is the top guy. And he has put Joseph in charge. And the one thing I want to reemphasize, if you remember this, just tells you just how much power Joseph had. Don't forget, Pharaoh gave him his signet ring, which essentially gave him the ability to make anything, make every decision that needed to be made, and have the authority with that seal, with Pharaoh's seal, to make that decision. And it was to be binding. He basically had Pharaoh's authority to make any decision, do anything he wanted to do. It's an amazing thing that where God moved him to, where he was, and how God moved him up that ladder and put him in this place for such a time as this, if you would, to quote Esther. All right? Mordecai, I guess, actually. But in verses 1 through 3 of Genesis chapter 42, I think these are kind of interesting verses to me because they reveal something in the hearts of Jacob's sons that I think very often takes place in the hearts of believers. And in fact, we see a little picture of this, I think, in the New Testament as well. But let's go ahead and take a look at that. I want to just read these verses. It says, "Now when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, why do you look one upon another?" It's kind of an interesting statement. He says, and he said, "Behold, I've heard that there's corn in Egypt. Get you down thither. Buy for us from thence, and we may live and not die." And Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn in Egypt. Now, when I think about that, he basically says, what are you guys doing just standing around staring at each other? We're in the midst of famine, guys. We have nothing to eat. Now, realize these guys are grown men. These are grown men with families of their own. They've got children to take care of. They've got wives to take care of. They've got livestock that needs to be taken care of. And they're standing around going, "Oh, what do we do? What do we do?" And Jacob's going, what are you guys doing? You're just standing around staring at each other when there's work to be done, because something has to happen or your families are going to die. You're just standing there waiting for someone else, Jacob, to make a decision. Or perhaps they're just waiting for God to rain down a miracle upon them. But for whatever the case, they're just standing around, staring at each other, not knowing which way to go, not knowing what to do. And for some reason, as soon as I read that, the verses that kind of jumped in my mind was over there in Acts chapter 1 and verse 11. It says, "You men of Galilee, why stand you gazing up into heaven?" You know, here are these guys, you know, Jesus had just left, and they're standing there staring like, man, that was so cool. And it's like, no, you got stuff to do. You got to stop that. Get out here and get some work done. We've got people that need to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's folks that need to be discipled. You've got families to take care of. You've got jobs to do. Let's get it done. You can't just stand out here staring up into the sky all day. And I kind of get that same picture here with Jacob. He's like, listen, guys, you need to do something. You can't just stand here. Now, the interesting thing to me, and where I think it has a lot to do with even where we get to sometimes, is two places. Number one is standing around hoping somebody else is going to do it for us. All right? But number two, thinking, you know what, God's just going to rain a miracle down on me. I'm just going to wait for it. And I think sometimes, you know, God has given us a brain, guys. He's given us some common sense. He's provided for us. He's given us opportunities to be able to accomplish things and given us the wisdom and the understanding to see these things and to be able to accomplish them. You know, simply because we're God's children doesn't mean we just stand around and wait for something supernatural or some miracle of God to fall on us. He expects us to take what he has given us and do something with it. I mean, think about this. Look at all that God went through in the life of Joseph to bring him to a place where he would provide corn, all right, in Egypt for all the world to come to, but especially for Jacob's family to come to so he can get them where he wants them to be. All right, God has been planning this all along. And now's the time. And so here they are going, what do we do now? And Jacob just states the obvious. He says, guys, there's corn in Egypt. What do you mean, what do? You go down and get corn. Do you have corn? No, we don't have any corn. Egypt has corn. You know, just try this on for size. Why don't you get up and go down there and get some? All right? So there are some times and some things that we need to see in our own life that says, you know, don't just stand around and wait for God, but look for those provisions that God has already made. You know, if you think about it, sometimes we will say silly things and do silly things. I've heard guys say, you know, they'll come to me. I get this all the time. I'll get people coming into the church on a regular basis wanting things, all right? Yeah, wanting a handout. And you know what? If there's a genuine need, it's not that I have an issue with that. There's a genuine need and what have you. But, you know, I get tired of hearing the stories about, you know, not working and not even trying to get a job and not doing those kinds of things and wondering why God's not taking care of them. It's like, you know what? Because you're not utilizing the provisions. God is taking care of you. God has provided for you. God has provided the means for things to happen in your life. You've just chosen in your own life not to utilize them. It's not God that hasn't done his job. It's us quite often. By the way, let me throw this at you, because I think this is a bad statement, and godly people will use it all the time. Christian people think this is a great statement. And many of you probably, as well as myself, have maybe said this at some time or another, but it's just not a true statement. People will sometimes come to us with maybe legitimate problems or things going on in their life and everything, you know, and we'll say, don't worry, God will take care of it. That's not a true statement, guys. It's just not a true statement. And I say that because, yes, God can take care of it. Yes, God may take care of it. But I'm not God, and God doesn't answer to me. And for me to make a blanket statement like that on God's behalf is who am I? Who am I to say God's going to take care of this? He hasn't promised he'd take care of everything. In fact, I would imagine, you know, when you look at the apostles' lives, you know, they all died for the cause of Jesus Christ. They all died, and basically none of them died wealthy, all right? And if someone would have come along to them and they said, you know, I'm struggling eating today, well, don't worry, God will take care of it. Well, not necessarily. Paul may have said, you know, no, that's not necessarily true. I think I need to find somebody that needs, you know, that needs a good wallet that I can make for him, you know. Do a little leather work so that I can have some funds so I can do those things. God's given me that ability. God's provided for me. Now what I need to do is use what God has given me so that I can provide for those things. Sometimes what we're doing is giving them an excuse to do nothing. Because what happens is we need to say, well, look at the provisions that God has made in your life. Look at the things God has put out there so that you might be able to accomplish these things in your life. By the way, when I say this, I don't mean to sound like God hasn't provided. What I'm trying to tell you is that God may have already provided for such things, and we just haven't taken advantage of it. When I'm looking for something supernatural, rather than looking for the provisions God's already made, you know, maybe I fell down and broke my wrist, and I don't understand why God doesn't just miraculously heal it. Well, he's already made provisions. There's a guy up here at Mercy Hospital that's really good at that. And I have insurance, and I have the ability to go there and get it fixed. All right? God has already provided for me. All right? And so sometimes we have to think about that. You know, God has made provisions for us. In his case, for example, they may have been standing around thinking, okay, well, let's just wait for God to rain corn out of heaven. All right? But what they didn't see is where the supernatural event started. The supernatural event started with a dream he had given Joseph when he was just a kid. In fact, the supernatural event continued when even the brothers themselves sold him into slavery. And then those guys sold him to Potiphar in Egypt, who jailed him and then dealt with the butler in interpreting his dream. The butler to Pharaoh, who then 2 years later shared with Pharaoh, hey, there's a guy there and it was in jail that can interpret your dream, giving him the ability to do just that. And then not only that, but then Pharaoh causing him to step up into such a position as he is in so that, you know, so that he could accomplish things, giving Pharaoh this dream. And then not only that, but giving them 7 years of plenty so that they would have the goods to supply not only for themselves, Egypt, but enough goods to provide for everybody in the ancient world who was suffering from the same famine so that they could come and buy from Egypt and be cared for, specifically the Hebrew children. All right? The miracle started a long time ago. So to say, are they standing around looking for a miracle? The miracle they were looking for happened 30 years prior to this. I mean, the miracle they were looking for happened, what did I say, 30? I said 30, 20, 20 years. 20 years prior to this time, roughly, about. All right? Now, so what happens here is they don't see the obvious. And the obvious was actually a provision that God had already put in place. Sometimes as children of God, here's what we do. We look for miracles when God has already provided for us. We just don't look for that provision. You know, how am I going to buy food today? Well, God gave you a job. You know, he'll take care of that. You have the provision. All right? There are some things, by the way, we don't even have to pray about. Do you know that? You realize some things you don't have to pray about? You don't have to pray about things that are direct commands. God says pray. Do you have to pray about whether or not you ought to pray? Do you have to pray about whether or not you ought to study God's word? No. Do you have to pray about whether or not you should tell people about Jesus Christ? No. There are things in our life we really don't have to pray about. And if we see the provisions, if we see what God has done, in all honesty, those aren't even things we need to pray about. Because if God gave me a job to buy food for my home, and my home needs food, and I have the provisions in my hand, and God provided for that, I don't necessarily need to pray, God, should I use this money to buy the provisions? Because we already know that's why he provided the money. So just go do what he said to do. So here these guys are in a situation to where Jacob's scratching his head going, Egypt's got corn. Why don't we just go there and buy some? All right? Well, these guys are standing around going, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? Another thing they might have been looking for, however, they might have been looking for Jacob to have some word from God. You know? Because keep in mind, it's a patriarch society. They're all looking to Jacob because he is the father of the nation, basically, at this point in time. He's the guy. He's the go-to guy. And so they might be looking to him for a word from the Lord. It says go. And I find that ironic because they may have been waiting for him to say, God has told us that what we ought to do. But he didn't do that. Instead, I mean, I wonder what they must have thought. Instead, he said, Egypt's got corn. Go buy some. You know. And it's amazing sometimes how spiritual we get. I'm going to wait for God. And God said, wait a minute. I've already provided. Don't wait for me. I've already took care of this. I'm 20 years ahead of you guys. Just do what you need to do right now. All right? I've already provided for it. So when I look at this whole picture, that's what I see. All right? They had nothing to eat. Egypt had plenty to eat. And so they need to just go do it. You know, I've had guys argue with me about medical care. Should we, as children of God, should we go to the doctor or should we just trust God? Go to the doctor. Go to the doctor. God provided them for us. God gave them guys the wisdom, gave them the understanding. You know, I'm going to share this story just because I thought it was a cool story. It might make a difference of who you go to. It might make a difference of who you deal with. My son, at one particular point when he was at the doctor, I'm trying to think of what her name was. We just called her Doc K. Klazuski. I think her name was Klazuski. She was Polish. I think it was Klazuski. I could be wrong about that, but it was a hard name to pronounce. All right? And she's working on him, and she's doing. And it was so funny because it wasn't at this particular time. He had never asked this before. It never occurred to him before. But he stopped her because it was kind of a big deal they were doing that day. And keep in mind, it was shortly after he had been saved and that kind of thing. And he stops her. And she goes, what do you need, Chris? He goes, are you saved? And she goes, you mean have I trusted Christ? He goes, yes. And she goes, I have. He goes, can we pray before we do this? And it just like broke my heart, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm his dad, and I didn't think of this, you know. He thinks of it. But I make that point to say this. He recognized something. He recognized that, look, God has provided this woman for me. God's put her here. So I want to make sure I got God's leadership in this. And I want to make sure God's hand's all over it. Now, he's just a little guy. He's just a kid. But I think he really saw that. And I really think he grasped that aspect. I think we need, as Christians, to grasp that. That God has made these provisions for us. He has provided for us. And he will even use us in those provisions to do great things. You know, this whole thing, just the fact that this whole provision brought Joseph and his brothers back together just like God intended for them to. created a forgiveness there, created great things that we'll talk about later, you know, in another chapter. But nonetheless, these things took place because God, 20 years before, started making provisions for him. And Jacob said, God's made provisions. This is going to take advantage of it. All right? So sometimes we just need to see that God has made these provisions. In verse 4, keep in mind that Benjamin was Jacob's youngest son, and he was also, from his point of view, because he thought Joseph was dead, he was also the only surviving son of his beloved Rachel. All right? So he was going to be very protective of him. So when he tells his sons to go and get corn in Egypt, he doesn't include Benjamin in that. Benjamin's probably still pretty young here. I don't know his exact age, but he's definitely young at this moment and at this point. And so he wants to be sure that no harm comes to him. Keep in mind, I mean, Rachel was the wife that he loved, cared for, and his son Joseph, whom he loved dearly, in his mind is dead. And so Benjamin's all he's got. Rachel died giving birth to Benjamin. So, you know, it's a situation to where he's not going to let anything happen to Benjamin if he can help it. He's going to hold him close, all right? And so in verse 4, he sends the 10 sons out and hangs on to Benjamin. Then in verse 5, as instructed, the sons go to Egypt to buy food. And although we already know that the famine must have extended to Jacob's family, we're given the confirmation in this verse. He just says it again. The famine had clearly stretched beyond the borders of Egypt. Just so you don't get the idea that the famine is only in Egypt. Because Egypt is the controlling nation of that ancient world at that time. When he says Egypt, he's talking about all that they have dominion of, you know. And so, you know, it's the same thing. It's kind of true when you get in the New Testament and you start talking about Rome. You kind of talk about everything. It's not just Rome. At times it is, but it's all the providences that basically are under their jurisdiction, which is all that ancient world. And so what we find in this situation is when he talks about Egypt, he just wants to make sure we understand. You know, this is beneficial for us. It's beneficial for the writers, I mean, for the readers at the time, because keep in mind, again, emphasize this, Moses is writing about events that took place long before his time, all right? And so he's writing under the inspiration of God. And so doing, we know it to be accurate, obviously. And so as he's writing this, he's sharing with them things that they probably have come to know. And so it helps them put two and two together. So we're looking at this whole situation, and we realize, okay, their land experiences famine from time to time. And at that time, even their land, the land that God will later call, you know, fruitful, you know, with milk and flowing with milk and honey. But that's the land they're living in right now. And so their land is experiencing famine along with Egypt. So he's just making sure we do understand that this famine has extended beyond just the boundaries of Egypt. Verses 6 through 8 is interesting to me because let's read those. I want to read those so that we get a grip on it. He says, and Joseph was the governor over the land, and he it was that sold to all the people of the land. Joseph's brethren came and bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. And Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them. He made himself strange unto them and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, whence come ye? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew him, they knew not him. And so the picture here is this. The brethren come to Joseph. We need to buy corn. And Joseph recognizes who they are right away. I mean, keep in mind, Joseph was, you know, the last time they saw him was, what, 17? You know, now he's 37, all right? So he's 20 years older. I say now he's 37 because we know this. We know that when Pharaoh set him up as governor, he said, the Bible tells us he was 30 years old at that time. We also know the 7 years has elapsed. Those are the plenty years. We're into the famine years, so he's at least 37, all right? So we know that much. He could be a little older. We could be up a year or two into the famine. I don't know. But nonetheless, we know he's at least 37 here. So this is 20 years difference. A lot can change from a guy going from 17 to 37. But yeah.
Wouldn't you think, though, that the brothers already knew he was sold as a slave? Slaves don't become that.
Oh, well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, there's like there's a bunch of reasons why they probably wouldn't have recognized him. Number one, when they first come up to him, they're not looking to recognize him because they're going to show homage. It tells you clearly they have their face to the ground. They're not looking at him at this point because they don't want to do anything that's going to prevent them from getting the corn. Okay, but that doesn't mean that they don't see him face to face at certain points. But I'm just saying that they're not expecting this. This is not who they're looking for. So they weren't looking for him in that position because he was sold into slavery. He was obviously dressed differently. It says he disguised his voice, told him that, we see that. And when we're talking about dressed differently, I think, and he does, he speaks through an interpreter as well. So he's speaking to them in the Egyptian tongue, I would imagine. And so, the interpreter is interpreting that for them in their tongue. We're getting all these different things that are taking place where he clearly wants them not to recognize him, first of all, but it might be tough to recognize him anyway because, quite frankly, like you said, he was sold into slavery. They're never going to see him again. It's not even on their mind that they're ever going to see him again. The last thing they expect is to stand before him, who is literally the mightiest, strongest, most powerful guy, literally, in all the world as far as, just political power. With the exception of Pharaoh. And here he is. And not only that, but like I said, they hadn't seen him for 20 years. And in addition to that, I mean, he treated them as though he didn't know them. And like we said, he talked Egyptian, communicated with them through an interpreter. That's in verse 23. We haven't got that far, but you can read up ahead and see that. All these things are taking place. And by the way, if you're not expecting to see somebody, how often have you seen people you know really well and not recognize them? I mean, I've done that with people I'm very close to, but see them in a different surrounding. See them in a different place than what you're accustomed to seeing them. I ran into a pastor friend one day. I've only seen him at pastor's conferences or at pastor's meetings, always, in a suit and always, and that's the place I've ever seen him. I'm at Tri-County, we're at Tri-County, and I run into him at Lowe's, and he's walking towards me. He's got on a t-shirt and a pair of shorts and a pair of gym shoes, and he's holding this woman's hand that I had never met, all right? And I'm just strolling along, and I walk close enough I could brush up against him, and he's a good friend of mine, supposedly. And he's like, Barry, and I'm like, seriously? I've never seen you like this. I did not recognize the guy until he called my name. And when he called my name and I looked at him, then I'm looking at him thinking, this is my I know. And so then your mind starts running, how you do. And I figured out who it was immediately. But I just didn't recognize him because, number one, he wasn't in the environment I expected him to be in. Wasn't dressed like I expected him to be dressed. And didn't talk. We hadn't communicated. We hadn't made eye contact, really, just saw him. And I could have walked right by him and never have known that I ran into him that day. And you wonder how many times you do that, But I do that stuff all the time. So in this situation, I don't find it difficult to believe that they didn't recognize him. I really don't. I don't find that difficult at all for them to say, man, I don't recognize this guy, So I'm just saying. Nonetheless, they did not know it was Joseph, but he recognized them. But now, why would he recognize them? I think for several reasons. I think he was looking for them to come. I think everybody that came before him, he was looking, is this my brothers? Because they're going to be here. Is this my brothers? Because one day they're going to be here. They're going to be here. And so I think that he was continually looking for them. And then when they came, he was looking to see if it was them, first of all. But secondly, they probably hadn't changed as much as he had changed because they knew him when he was younger. And so he would recognize them more readily. But not only that, but I think he just knew who they were. He recognized them. And so so that's a situation. But in verses 6 through 8, we see something else here. I think the Bible tells us they bowed before him for a specific reason. You remember what we read back in chapter 37? Exactly, the dream that he had. Remember the dream that his brothers would bow down to him? Then he had another dream that not only his brothers would bow down, but his dad would bow before him, and they all get mad at him. This is what kind of started it off for him to say, hey, listen, what's up with that? Who do you think you are? You're saying you're going to be in charge over us? You're going to rule over us? We see that dream coming to pass at this moment where all the family bows down before Joseph. And that's interesting to me. You know what I find interesting? I'm just going to throw this at you. This is silly Barry thinking. You have a puzzle about why God chose for Christ to come through the lineage of Judah rather than Joseph? You ever think about that? I've often thought about that, to be quite honest with you. I thought that seems odd to me, because the bulk of the one that's spoken of the most in Genesis is Joseph. He's the guy that, I mean, we get the picture after picture after picture of Jesus Christ in his life. And yet, Judah, we see some silliness that goes on. But nonetheless, in the case of Judah, we find that God made Judah a promise that the Messiah would be born through his lineage. And I just always have puzzled over that, thought that was interesting that he had chosen to do so. But here's what we find in the life of Joseph. Keep in mind that Ephraim, his son, is not even mentioned again when you get into Revelation as one of the 12 tribes. And yet the 10 tribes, the northern tribes, all the way through the Old Testament, are sometimes called Israel, sometimes called the northern kingdom, and sometimes called Ephraim. And yet, when you get into Revelation, Ephraim is no longer mentioned. And it's just kind of an interesting thing. I'm going to throw a thing at you, because you might run into it when the Mormons knock on your door. The Mormons believe Ephraim is a lost tribe, that they just somewhere disappeared because they're not mentioned in Revelation. And the Mormons believe that the lost tribe of Ephraim is basically the Native Americans. All right, it's basically America. People, this is what the Mormons. I don't believe this. I'm not teaching this. Don't go tell somebody Barry said this. No, I did not. That's what the Mormons believe. So, you know, when you see something, when they come knocking on your door and they start talking about, you know, being a part of the tribe of literally part of Israel, that's what they're talking about. They believe that they're a part of that lost tribe of Ephraim. And I tell you why I wouldn't want to be a part of that lost tribe of Ephraim at another time. But nonetheless, that's what they believe. That's what they'll teach you. But that's where they get that. They believe that they left somewhere along the line. They left and they migrated here, and they are the ones that are that migrated here and was the first to populate America. All right. Anyway, I don't know why I got into that. Now I'm all lost. I'm all confused. All right. But anyway, verse 9. Not only are we able to see Joseph's dreams come to pass, but Joseph is also well aware that his dreams are coming to pass. We're not the only ones that sees this, right? Joseph's like, oh, I remember my dream, and here it is. It's happening right now. And so he's very aware that God is working in this. You know, there was a time in Joseph's life while he was sitting in jail where he's going, God, what's going on? And now here he is going, God, look what you did. Look what you have done. I talked about this. I don't remember if it was this past Sunday or the Sunday before, but it amazes me sometimes if I stop and look back over my life and I look at things that I'm living right now that are answered prayers from who knows when, you know, back, maybe even gave up on the prayer at some point in time. Maybe even, you know, have had points and times in my life where I thought, I guess, you know, I'm just praying for something that shouldn't happen. And now, looking back, I remember praying for things that I look at my life now and I'm going, God, I remember praying for this. And look at my life, and I didn't even know it was coming. And I didn't even realize it when it got here. I didn't even realize you had answered that prayer until I began to examine my life and watch things slowly move and slowly work together. And things just kind of happened in my life. And then it came a time where I hadn't even realized God answered it. And you begin to look at your life and you go, man, my life is full of answered prayers that I prayed years ago. And I didn't even realize God had answered them. And I think that's an amazing thing. But here Joseph is. Keep in mind, he was at a time when he was praying for things and wasn't really seeing results, or he didn't think he was. And all the while, God's working in his life, but he's at a point now where he can look back and go, God, there's the answer. There's that dream. There's that dream that I dreamed when I was just a kid. There's the answer to the dream. Here's my brothers bowing before me, just like the dream said. That's an amazing thing. No, no, he didn't. In fact, you know, you never really see, in all the characters of the Bible, you talk about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, you know, you can even walk down through just about all of those sons of Jacob. And the one that you can grab that, in all honesty, you can't really find fault with is Joseph. And God never reveals any real faults with Joseph all the way through Scripture. He's a man of God, committed to God, doing what God has called him to do. It's just an amazing thing to me. Yeah, just the 10 of them are before him. Yeah, good point. That is a good point. Just the 10 of them that are there present. Yep. You know, verses 10 through 24, I'm not going to get into this a great deal, but I do want to say a few things, and that's this. Basically, it just spells out what's taking place, okay? We kind of all know the story. What takes place here is he accuses them of being spies because he's got to make sure of some things. He knew how they treated him. He has concern for his brother Benjamin, all right? And so he knows how they've treated him, so he's got to put them to the test. He's got to make sure their hearts are different. He needs to make sure these guys have matured, make sure things have changed before he just reveals himself. So what he does is he has them basically arrested for being spies, so they spend about 3 days in jail. And so he tells them, he says, look, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to let you go back home, and I'm going to provide you with the things that you want to buy. You give me the money, we'll buy those things, and let you take those back, but here's the deal. When you come back again, I want you to bring your brother with you. I want to meet this brother because I want to be sure that you really are a family. This is what he's telling him. I want to be sure you really are a family, okay? I want to make sure you're not just a bunch of spies out here. And I would imagine that's a real concern because keep in mind, the only people in all the world that's got food is Egypt. So if you want food, you come to Egypt. What do you do if you can't afford to buy it? What do you do if you're a stark raven enemy of Egypt, you know? They probably got a lot of folks who are basically just wanting to steal the food, maybe kill the leaders of Egypt and take over Egypt. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of that going on. So he's got to be concerned about such things. And so he accuses them of being spies. You know, you guys might be spies. I got to be sure this is good. And so after spending 3 days in jail, he says, okay, here's what I've decided to do. I'm going to give you food, take it back home with you, but don't come again until you bring your younger brother with you, because I want to make sure the next time you come, I want to be sure you really are the family you say you are. And by the way, just to make sure all this goes down, I need one of you to stay here in jail. Simeon stays, all right? So this is basically what happens. All this kind of goes down. He does something here that's kind of interesting because he wants them to know, listen, the reason I'm doing this is because I really do fear God like you fear God. Now that's something, if he just blatantly says that, if he just throws that out there, hey, listen, I believe in the same God you believe in, it's going to throw up some red flags, all right? But he does tell them in verse 18 that he fears the same God they fear, all right? So prior to that, before he ever tells them that, he kind of swears by Pharaoh first, all right? He says, by the way, he says, I just want you to know that, you know, all that you're doing and all that's being done, you know, I have Pharaoh's hand. I make decisions for Pharaoh, and I'm telling you that I'm doing this by the hand of Pharaoh. And so he essentially is swearing by Pharaoh. He's saying, I have Pharaoh's charge, and so if you aren't who you say you are, you need to understand it's not just about me. Pharaoh will have you killed, all right? So he makes it pretty clear that he's working for Pharaoh. From all indication, he's an Egyptian. He's a part of Egypt. So he's got to drive that home, but he also wants them to know, I'm kind of on your side too. I want you to know that you can have a buddy here. I fear the same God you fear. But if he'd have just blatantly said that, it might have made them think, I wonder if he's, you know, if there's a clue to that. He wants to make sure that's not happening, but he also wants to send a picture that they can know that, you know, he'll provide for them and that he'll be there for them. So I think that's kind of interesting. He doesn't tip his hat, but he also kind of makes sure that everything just kind of, you know, still works the way he wants them to work. And so, you know, that whole concept. In addition to sending them back, all right, he sends them back, and you know what? I'm going to skip that. That's a little bit of a reach, and I don't really have time to do that. All right. I should, but I don't want to take the time to do that. By the way, he has obviously never forgotten what they had done to him either. And so what he's doing here is he's making sure they do remember that. And the big thing is they haven't forgotten. Look in verses 21, 22, verse 28. These guys immediately, what happens is they're looking at this situation. And they're going, man, this is not good. You know, Dad's not going to be happy. We're going to get back home. We're not going to have Simeon. He's going to be upset. Simeon's not here. Joseph, you know, is gone. And this is not going to be a good thing. Dad's not going to be happy. And then when we tell him we can't come back again without Benjamin, this is not good. And so their issue is, listen to what they do. Immediately, look in verses 21, 22, and then again in 28. Basically, they say, God's taken out vengeance on us because of what we did to Joseph. Man, this is a long time later. I mean, we're talking way down the road. We're talking 20 years later, and they're still going, I feel guilty over what we did with Joseph. And God is coming to get us. I see God's hand coming on all of this. And they're going like, you know what? I see God dealing with us on this issue. And I think that's so interesting to me, because what happens is it weighs heavy on them. You know, it's that whole concept that, you know, that sin always has its debt. I mean, it's always that payday, you know. Who was it? Who preached Payday Someday? R.G. Lee. Yeah, I heard somebody say it, but I didn't hear it enough to get it. Yeah. Payday Someday. And it's kind of that thought. There's a day where there's a payday coming. And they knew that. And you're right. There's never been a point where we see any repentance. We never see a point where they confessed it. We never see a point where they do anything like they're supposed to. Instead, they deal with the guilt for 20 years. And so here they are. Now they're realizing, you know what? This is the place. This is the time. God's taking care of it. Yeah, this is not going to be good. All right. And I'm going to stop there. And we'll pick up the last bit next week, and then we'll get into the next chapter also. All right. But that's where this is. And keep in mind, I mean, if you go away from here and don't get anything else, get this. You're not going to get away with sin. You're just not going to get away with it. It'll eat at you. There is a guilt that will gnaw at you until we confess it, until God deals with it in our heart and our minds, until we understand and know that we have made things right with God. That's going to be something that just gnaws at us. These guys have been wrestling with that sin for 20 years. And you know what? You can tell right here, immediately, when something happens, where something goes wrong, the first thing they think of is, oh, it's that sin. I shouldn't have, we should have done, we should have taken care of that. I know, yeah. I told you we shouldn't have done this. Yep, you're right. That's exactly what he does. All right. We'll see more about this next week. Are you guys still okay with Genesis? You still enjoying it, all right? Okay, good deal. Let's go ahead and stand, and we'll pray. Boy, it's good to see all of you tonight. Thanks for...